Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Well, today we have another privilege of hearing our old wild man, Zen and Buddhist scholar, Jim Wilson, on part two of a series on bodhicitta.
Yes. Thank you. I think.
Yes.
So, let's begin with taking refuge. So, we take refuge in the Buddha, we take refuge in the Dharma, we take refuge in the Sangha. So, do people have any Dharma questions, questions about practice, or questions about the teaching that have come up in the last month, or about what I talked about last month? Wonderful. So, what I'm talking about is giving a series of talks on the idea of bodhicitta, which is the turning in one's consciousness so that one begins to practice for the benefit of all sentient beings, instead of practicing for one's benefit alone. So it's a shift in one's perspective. That's the basic core meaning of bodhicitta. And for those of you who were not here last month, the text I'm using to base these talks on is called the 37 Practices of the Bodhisattvas. So the opening verse of the 37 verses is, I pay constant homage through my three doors to my supreme teacher and protector, Chen Rezig, who, while seeing all phenomena lack coming and going, makes single-minded effort for the good of all living beings. So I have to apologize having an allergy thing today, so I'm going to be snorting and snuffling, but I'm sure that you, with equanimity, can let that go. So last week I talked about the first line, I pay constant homage through my three doors, and actually, I talked only about the first part, the first line. Paying constant homage is a way of expressing the understanding of gratitude. And gratitude is the key to the shift in practice, which brings about the ability to practice for the benefit of all sentient beings. So that's why it begins with an homage. It's an expression of gratitude. The three doors, expressing gratitude through my three doors, refer to body, speech, and mind. So through the three doors of body, speech, and mind. Doors is an interesting way of expressing it. So if you think of a door that's open, that's a good symbol of emptiness. So a door that is open can allow anything to come in and anything to leave. It's a wonderful expression for non-clinging. It's like a symbol of that. So, body, speech, and mind. So, first, mind is, I pay homage with my mind by being aware of all that has been given to me, primarily the gift of the Dharma, which has been passed down for many, many, many centuries, without which I would not be able to practice today at all. So that's paying homage with my mind, being aware of that. Paying homage with speech is actually saying thank you out loud. So this can be done at one's home altar. It can be done ritually with a group. It's an interesting... there's an interesting, vibrational difference between just thinking about it and actually saying it out loud. And with body means to bring it into, traditionally in Buddhism, it would be like a gesture of bowing, you know, like, or prostration to express the thanks. So the body, speech, and mind, then I express homage with my whole body. Like, and it's incidentally, that's one of the functions of ceremony in the Dharma, not just in the Dharma, but in all spiritual traditions. One of the functions of ceremony is to incorporate the body into the practice, so that it's not just just an idea or just something we talk about. So so like the use of incense, the use of bells, the use of candles brings in the what I call it the sensorium, you know, like the sensory apparatus. It gives it an opportunity, ceremony gives one an opportunity to focus all of one's sensory capacities into the practice. You know, like, so if when you light incense, ring a bell, chant, then there's the visual display of the altar. See, normally our sensory, our sensorium is scattered. That is, we hear something in the distance, we're seeing something else, you know, like we're smelling a third thing. You know, like, so it's sort of checking in. If you think of the six realms of sensation, you know, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, they're often sort of off in different directions. You know, like, so the mind is thinking about one thing, you're hearing a different thing, you're smelling something else. You know, like, so one of the functions of ceremony is to bring all that together so that there is a focus, so that it's not scattered. So that's one of the things which makes ceremony a powerful tool for a spiritual practice. Do people have questions on that? Does that make sense? Or observations? The second line says, to my supreme teacher and protector, Chen Rezig. So he's paying homage specifically to Chen Rezig. Chen Rezig is Avalokiteshvara in Tibetan. Avalokiteshvara has many names. So many of you know Avalokiteshvara is Kuan Yin in Chinese. In Japanese, either Kanzian or Kanan. In Korean, Kwanseum. I don't know the Vietnamese pronunciation, sorry. But Avalokiteshvara is the symbolic representation of a particular aspect of the Buddha, and that aspect is the aspect of infinite compassion. So at the end of the 16th chapter in the Lotus Sutra, there's a series of verses which are very beautiful. It's called the Verses of Eternity. And at the end, the Buddha says to his disciples, I am ceaselessly thinking, I am endlessly contemplating, how can I awaken all sentient beings? So it's that aspect, if you think of that aspect of the Buddha, and personify that, you would have Avalokiteshvara, the a being of infinite compassion. So if you took the Buddha's a discourse of the Buddha's on the nature of emptiness or dependent origination, and you personified that aspect of the Buddha, you might come up with Manjushri, a bodhisattva of wisdom, the infinite compassion aspect is being emphasized here because bodhicitta is practicing for the benefit of all sentient beings. So it's this aspect of the practice which is being paid homage to. It is this aspect. It's interesting about the Buddha. There's a number of discourses, I've talked about this here before, but it's worth repeating, that describe the Buddha's feelings right after he became enlightened. And his initial feeling, he was very reluctant to teach after his enlightenment. Like, and in one of the discourses, the great god Brahma Sahampati appears before the Buddha and says, no, this is, you must teach. You know, like, this is a very rare event, a Buddha in the world, so you need to do this. And the Buddha actually argues with Brahma and says, but it would be a great burden to me, it would be wearisome. people are steeped in ignorance, thickly layered with ignorance and grasping and desire, and it's a long list that we're all intimately familiar with. So how would how would I be able to communicate this? And Brahma Sampati says, well, that's not entirely true. There are many people who have but little dust. They will be able to hear what you have to say. So at that point, the Buddha decides that he'll give it a try. He goes to his five former friends, gives his first sermon on the Four Noble Truths, and one of them, by the name of Kaundinya, awakens. He understands. He understands what the Buddha has said. So that's a good start. His first Dharma talk, and somebody gets it, and then he begins his teaching career. But that turning in the Buddha's mind was, in a way, the arising in him of bodhicitta. That decision of his that I'm going to try and communicate this understanding to other people is in itself a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, within the Buddha's own mind and heart. I'm not going to go off to the Himalayas and sit in a cave. I'm going to assist other people in this. The verse refers to Chen Rezig as the supreme teacher and protector. So compassion is the supreme teacher. What does compassion mean? Compassion means that state of consciousness and understanding when you wish other people to be free from suffering. So when that spontaneously arises within you, which it does for everybody, that is the enlightened mind manifesting. See, enlightenment is not an all or nothing. You can be partially enlightened, enlightened to a degree. That's how you know that Buddha nature is within you, when that mind appears. See? So it's not mysterious, but you need to recognize it. That's what's being referred to. So when spontaneously rising within you the wish that someone else be free from suffering, that's it. That's the enlightened mind. That's bodhicitta. That's the same mind as the Buddha is saying, I'm ceaselessly pondering how to save sentient beings from suffering. Well, we're not ceaselessly doing it, but we're doing it to a degree, and that's the point, that it's not something that you have not experienced. So Chen Rezig is the supreme teacher because Avalokiteshvara identifies that consciousness and that frame of mind and then teaches us how to cultivate that awareness, how to awaken completely to it, and thereby become a Buddha. Did you have an observation or question?
What do you make of this arising of bodhicitta in the Buddha's story not being simultaneous with his awakening, but being a consequence of some further activity in control?
Here's what I make of it, as long as you ask. Wisdom and compassion are not do not have a necessary causal relationship to each other. That's the meaning of that story. Okay. So that insight by itself does not necessarily generate compassion. You can have one without the other. Right. So what that means is, in terms of a Buddhist context, that it's necessary to cultivate both. I often use the metaphor of the Dharma as a great bird, and there are two wings to this bird in order for it to take flight, and one of them is wisdom and one of them is compassion. So this took me a long time to understand. The reason it's difficult to understand is that they do not mutually exclude each other. They're not, if you look at, in a meditative state, if you look at your own consciousness, using practices of insight, it's possible for dhyana states and compassion states to simultaneously coexist. So that in some people, they do simultaneously arise because they're not states that mutually exclude each other. Right? So there are states of mind which are excluded by the presence of wisdom, and there are states of mind which are excluded by the presence of compassion. But those two states of mind eventually merge like pouring milk into water. For some people it takes a while. For those who experience the simultaneous arising of wisdom and compassion, it's often difficult for them to see why someone who's very adept at wisdom does not seem to have an understanding of compassion. If they themselves have experienced this simultaneously, then why is it that this, why don't you get the connection? Why aren't you, and vice versa. That's my understanding of it. Is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, just one quick follow-up. So could you say that his first experience under the Bodhi tree before teaching was the fruition of an arhat stage? And then, you call it enlightenment there, and then the compassion is, you said compassion, I forget exactly how to phrase it, but the practice of compassion is enlightenment. Uh-huh. So, are there two enlightenments? I'm not sure.
Well, that's kind of a scholastic question, and to be honest with you, I'm not sure. The connection between wisdom and compassion, wisdom in Buddhism means the understanding of the interconnectedness of all things. And the falling away of any sense of a separately existing self. Hence, no self, if by self you understand a separately existing self. Now, what that gives to the mind is tremendous spaciousness. So, tremendous, a sense of vastness. See, the connection there is that allows heart wisdom, gives heart wisdom the room to blossom. As long as the mind is constricted, what the mind constricts is the possibility of infinite compassion. See, which is also why for many people it does simultaneously arise. With the opening of the mind, the heart goes, "Oh, good! Now I have room." I'm not saying there's no connection between the two, but I'm saying you can go, let's say, very, 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 very far in the direction of wisdom, and still not have a manifestation of compassion.
From the little I know of Tibetan perspective, I've been reading Golden's book on dialogue with the Dalai Lama. My understanding of their perspective is that destructive emotions and therefore bad action, which leads to an increase in suffering, is a result of failure to accurately perceive reality, to understand truth. And the reason I'm asking it, it's not just a question that I have academic concern about, because I was thinking recently that many, possibly all of the people that we think of as evil leaders are people who have, from the little I know, if you look back in their biographies, they started out, from their perspective at least, as idealists, that their intention was in some way to bring betterment to other people, you know, sometimes a narrowly constricted definition, and yet they did. They had destructive emotions and they did destructive things. And so the underlying issue is, are there evil people, or are there only those who, in Vishnahan's terms, do not yet see?
Well, you're asking my opinion on that. My tendency is to think that there are no evil people, though I would say there are evil deeds. Mm. You know, like, so as long as there is the belief in a separately existing self, one of the consequences of that can be, you know, like the kind of destructive activity that we see in the world today. You know, like, that's a difficult connection to make for many people. You know, like, and that's that's also one of the connections between wisdom and compassion. You know, like, compassion without wisdom is clumsy, often misdirected, can quite often cause more harm than good. You know, like, wisdom without compassion, you know, like, can have great insight, but can be tremendously destructive and be very adept at justifying itself. You know, like, without that compassion aspect. You know, like, so both are needed. You know, like, insight into the interconnectedness of all things is foundational for compassionate activity to be effective. You know, like, and compassion is necessary for wisdom not to get carried away in its own and become self-aggrandized. In Tibetan Buddhism, they picture this very well. Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom. So he carries a flaming sword. Like, and in his beneficent aspect, he's very attractive. The sword is the sword of wisdom, which cuts through ignorance and delusion. You know, like, cuts away ignorance and delusion. The very same bodhisattva, in its malevolent aspect, that is, wisdom without compassion, you know, like, dances on a field of corpses. It's not a flaming sword, it's a sword dripping blood. You know, like, wearing a necklace of entrails and holding a dripping skull, you know, like, in his left hand. You know, like, so, like, so the distance between, you know, like, wisdom that produces malevolent results and wisdom that produces compassion results, it's the same energy, you see. So that is, it's the sword of discrimination. You know, like, and the consequences of that, you know, can go either way. Like, and that's a very striking image in Tibetan Buddhism, too. So Chen Rezig is a teacher. And what Chen Rezig teaches, Avalokiteshvara teaches, is the possibility of compassion. But I want to go into a little bit more about the image of Avalokiteshvara, because Avalokiteshvara is the most mutable of bodhisattvas. Like, the most, in the 25th chapter, the Lotus Sutra is the chapter on Avalokiteshvara. And it's become so significant in East Asian Buddhism, particularly in China, Korea, and Vietnam, that it's become virtually a separate sutra. My teacher would chant the verse section of this chapter every day on a daily basis. Now, there's a section in there where Avalokiteshvara says, if people need to hear the Dharma from a monk, I will appear as a monk. If people need to hear the Dharma from a nun, I will appear as a nun. If people need to hear it from a king, I'll appear as a king. If they need to hear it from a housewife, I'll appear as a housewife. If people need to hear it from, you know, like, whoever, you know, like, and there, I think there's 32 or 33 manifestations, you know, like, that, and so, this is an image of what in Buddhism is called skillful means. Skillful means that in order to impart the Dharma to people, you must speak to them in a voice that they are capable of understanding and capable of hearing. You must speak to them in a way that is meaningful to them. You know, like you must accept their limitations. You know, like you must accept their perspective and move forward from there. Like so Avalokiteshvara in India, Chenrezig in Tibet is male. And when Avalokiteshvara first went to China, was male. And then over the centuries, was transformed into a very graceful feminine deity, Kuan Yin. And today, in China, and Korea and Japan, Kuan Yin has a very feminine cast. So that's also part of the mutability of Kuan Yin. That's an important teaching in itself. The compassion does not impose. That's the image, the one of the meanings of the image of Kuan Yin. There's a set of temples in Japan. I can't remember whether it's in Kyoto or Kamakura, but where each one of these manifestations of Kuan Yin has a temple, and they do a pilgrimage, to all. I can't remember whether it's 32 or 33, but manifestations. And so these days, you get on a bus, it takes you about 3 days, but anciently, it would take you a couple months to go to all the temples. But that's a very meaningful image. And one of the things, if you contemplate it, is that everyone is teaching you compassion all the time. Because everyone, you see, everyone spontaneously has within them that capacity to want others to be free from suffering. You have experienced this. When a friend is sick, someone close to you, or you read the paper, and they're suffering in some country, you just want them to be free from suffering. So everyone has this capacity. So everyone is, to a degree, Avalokiteshvara, whether they're a man, whether they're a woman, whether they're an animal, whether they're a deity. If you can hear that aspect, then the whole world is the body of Kuan Yin.
To step back, more perspective for a second, the emphasis on compassion and bringing other beings to enlightenment is sort of the root of the Mahayana tradition. But the idea of Avalokiteshvara is more universal. The idea of compassion being valuable would apply also in Theravadan tradition. So what would be the distinction, or how could you distinguish between compassion as an autonomous principle of practice and compassion as the origin or the founding principle of Mahayana?
I don't look at it that way. All these different Dharma traditions are pouring into America, one of the principles of Buddhist study is to not be attached to the words, but listen for the meaning. So take, for example, the practice of the four immeasurables in the Theravada tradition. That is the cultivation of bodhicitta. Particularly in its second aspect, but all four aspects. So just because they don't call it bodhicitta, just because they don't use that word, and Theravada Buddhism doesn't use that word, doesn't mean that the practice is not there. Like, there's a discourse from the Connected Discourses. The group is called the Discourses of Citta the Householder. This citta is different from the citta of bodhicitta, so just to be confusing. In the discourse I'm thinking of, a monk asks Citta the Householder, "What are the different practices of the Buddha the same in meaning, or different in form? Or are they different in meaning and different in form?" They're like, and so Citta the Householder takes five sets of practices, one of which is the four immeasurables, and one of them is emptiness, and I forget the other three. They're like, and his first answer is that they are different in meaning and different in form. And what he does is he goes through a very quick summary of how you practice. You know, like, and so the difference is very, very clear. You know, like what you're actually doing with your mind and body is different. You know. And then he says, from another perspective, they're the same in meaning, though different in form. The sameness in meaning that Citta the Householder alludes to is that they both lead to the experience, all of them lead to the experience of the immeasurable. And as a foundation for the experience of the immeasurable, they're the same in meaning. So when you experience immeasurable compassion, immeasurable love, immeasurable sympathy, you are experiencing, you know, like the limitless, the unbounded. So like when you experience the emptiness of all things, that also is an experience of the immeasurable, the boundless, the limitless. Like, and so they're the same in meaning. I think that's I love that discourse. That particular discourse is one of my favorites. You know, like, because it's very balanced. In one sense they are different. So that's my answer. That you know, like, in one sense the Theravada and the Mahayana are different because they have different practices. For example, the four foundations of mindfulness, that sutra doesn't exist in the Tibetan tradition. You know, like whereas in the Theravada tradition, it's absolutely central for meditative practice. You know, like, so in that sense, they're different. You know, like, but from another perspective, they have the same meaning. And the ultimate meaning is to awaken to the deathless, the unborn, the limitless, the uncreated. And that is what frees you from suffering, and not just you, all sentient beings. There's another discourse, one of my favorites, from the Pali Canon in the Book of Fours from the numerical collection, where the Buddha lists four kinds of disciples. You know, like the first kind of disciple practices just for themselves, not for others. The second kind of disciple practices for others, but not for themselves. The first kind of disciple practices neither for themselves nor for others. You know, like, because Indians have to be, you know, like, work out all the categories. And the fourth category is someone who works for themselves and for others. And then he goes through this, and then he says the fourth category is the highest category. He uses the butter metaphor, and the fourth category is ghee. You know, like, so that's, you know, you could have slotted that little sutta into dozens of Mahayana sutras. They're like, and no one would know the difference. No one would know that's not a Mahayana view. You know, like, I mean, it's very clear. You know, like, so I'm not saying that there are no differences. I think it's wonderful that there are all these different traditions because people have different needs for, they have different, like, Avalokiteshvara appearing as this, or appearing as that, or is appearing as that. Some people need respond to, or their path is the four foundations of mindfulness. That's what, you know, that's what resonates with them. That's what opens their minds and their heart. You know, like, other people respond to the four immeasurables. Other people respond to spacious awareness. You know, like, but the end point or the meaning, as Chitta, the householder, said, is the experience of the immeasurable. Is that responsive to your question? So the other aspect of Avalokiteshvara that the verse mentions is to my supreme protector. Now that's interesting. You know, like, not only is Avalokiteshvara the teacher, but also a protector. So in the sutra on Avalokiteshvara, this is something a lot of Westerners are uncomfortable with, you know, particularly us, the secular and scientific-minded people. The verse portion says, if I'm attacked by robbers, and I call upon the name of Kuan Yin, the robbers will disperse. You know, like if a fire is consuming my house and I call it Kuan Yin, the fire will be put out. You know, like if I, it goes through a long list of potential disasters, and if I call upon the name of Kuan Yin, then, you know, things will be taken care of. Sounds like magic, doesn't it? So like that's kind of, you know, but there are various ways you can take that. Though traditionally, there has been that relationship to Kuan Yin among Buddhist practitioners. You know, like calling upon the name of Kuan Yin for safety and protection. There are many, many stories about that, and if you're interested in those kinds of stories, I recommend John Blofeld's book about Kuan Yin, The Bodhisattva of Compassion. You know, like, so the Buddhist world, the Asian Buddhist world, is filled with wonderful stories of the power, the saving power of Kuan Yin. So those of you who are ex-Catholics, I think you can understand this kind of appeal. Like, you find everything in the Dharma. You know, like, so but the downside of viewing religion as protection is that when something bad does happen to you, it's like you've made a deal. You know, like, I'm going to practice, and the deal is you're going to protect me. So, you know, like, and the world is more complicated than that, you know, like, and more unpredictable than that. And so it's a poor foundation for practice, because something unpleasant is going to happen in life, you know, sooner or later. And then you go, like, well, where were you? You know, you know, like, you didn't do your job. You know, like, so there is something about calling upon the universe for assistance, calling upon the universe for help, calling upon the universe for, it's like a confession that I'm not wise enough, I'm not all-knowing enough. I've reached a point where I really can't handle this by myself, so I'm going to let go that I can figure all of this out. You know, like, and call upon the universe for assistance. If it's done in that spirit, there's a responsiveness to existence, and there's also a letting go of egotism, you know, like, which can be very powerful. You know, like, and I think that's why calling upon Kuan Yin for assistance often works for people. It's like there's a kind of a letting go of, oh, I'm in control here. You know, like, I'm going to manage all the factors. You know, like, it's a way of personifying that kind of opening to existence. You know, like, but if it's a deal, if it's a what I call spiritual calculus, you know, like, then it will be very subversive to one's ultimate understanding.
Jim, is there a battlefield image of Kuan Yin, or
not that I'm aware of? Yeah, that's other bodhisattvas step in for the battlefield function. Like, so, so the third line of the opening verse is, "Who, that is Avalokiteshvara, while seeing all phenomena, lack coming and going." So all phenomena. So here's this manifestation of compassion. So this is very, very similar to the opening lines of the Heart Sutra that some of you are familiar with. You know, like, Avalokiteshvara perceives that all five skandhas are empty and is saved from all suffering and distress. You know, like, so Avalokiteshvara perceives that the skandhas, that is, the factors which make up human existence, perceives the emptiness of form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness, really. And that perception saves Avalokiteshvara from all suffering and distress. So the meaning is very similar to this passage, that Avalokiteshvara perceives that all things lack coming and going. Why do they lack coming and going? When does the sunrise begin? When does the sunrise end? When does a person die? It's very interesting if you're with people who are dying. They're like, is it their last breath? Not really. You know, like, and some people seem to die years before their last breath. You know, like, I mean, in a sense. You know, like, and so when you start asking about phenomena, you know, like, when do they begin, when do they end, that begins to open you up to the idea of no coming and going, no appearing and no disappearing. So one of the discourses says, when appearing and disappearing disappear, that stillness is bliss. When appearing and disappearing disappear, that stillness is bliss. Like, so you have that understanding arises from the Buddha's primal insight into the interdependence of all phenomena. See, no phenomena exists isolatedly, you know, like separately. So when something begins depends on how you look at it. So for example, building a house, when does that house begin? With my idea? Well, when I finally contracted with an architect? When they start digging into the earth? When they complete it and I get to go in? You know, I can use it? You know, like, so if you understand the interconnectedness of all phenomena, coming and going begins to fall away. You know, like, that is the coming and going of discrete phenomena, separately existing phenomena. It's a very very subtle point, difficult to understand. I hope that I haven't further muddied the waters than that. So,
Jim, when you find a good point, we're
oh, but I could go on and on. Okay,
find a sublime.
Like endlessly. You see that? Deathlessly. One more, because then I'll finish the first verse and I'll feel like I've accomplished something. And the fourth is the fourth line is make single-minded effort for the good of all living beings. So that's the nature of Avalokiteshvara, is to have a single-minded effort for the benefit of all living beings. Once again, that's like the Lotus Sutra at the end of chapter 16. I am ceaselessly thinking. I am ceaselessly working and pondering. How can I save sentient beings and awaken them so that they too can become Buddhas? Now, is that possible? Is it possible for human consciousness to ceaselessly think about that? Yes, it is possible. For example, when you fall in love, what do you think about all the time? It's a wonderful feeling. You know, it's like, I mean, you may be shopping, you may be, you know, like on the phone talking to other people, but you're ceaselessly thinking about that person. You know, like, you're, you know, like, ceaselessly thinking about that person. So when you are studying for an exam, an important exam that's meaningful to you, you know, like, you're like, during that period, you'll ceaselessly sort of go over the questions and the data that you need to have, you know, like, to pass that exam and accomplish your goal. You know, like, so similarly, it is possible for someone to have a consciousness such that they are ceaselessly thinking, ceaselessly wondering, ceaselessly pondering. How do I save all sentient beings from suffering? How can I work toward that end? Right? And so I hope that we will all cultivate that understanding, awaken to our compassionate nature, and soon save all sentient beings from suffering. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.